From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. Eric, Mark, welcome. A pleasure as always.
Don.
Thank you, Don.
Eric.
Hey.
Mark.
All right.
Don.
So let's dive in.
Rocky boy.
It's Eric's turn this time. No, it's Mark's
Mark.
Turn. It's Mark's turn this time. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So let's dive in with the, you know, the breaking news that is still only barely being reported in the Western press. This is the news that we have had two further major erosions of Syrian sovereignty as, you know, the end game of the Syrian conflict comes into view. Anyone who thought that the U.S., Saudi, Turkey, you know, the assorted axis of jihadi-supporting allies here was just going to bow out with the gains that the Syrian Arab army is making thanks to Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah help across the country, advancing on 10 different fronts, turning back major counter-offensives staged out of Turkey, and keeping rolling. And this is where we start to see that Russia's real strategy for winning this conflict on the ground and forcing it to a final, I would say at this point, capitulation from a position of strength goes forward. But anyone who thought the U.S. was just going to accept that without at least making some further attempts, of course, is naive. We have seen reports that Turkey has crossed into Syria, troops this time, not just aircraft bombing Kurds, but troops into the vital, important Jarablus corridor, ostensibly to fight ISIS, but we know from the Kurds on the ground that they're not actually, of course, fighting ISIS. And in fact, Turkey and ISIS in the area are going completely out of their ways to completely avoid and ignore each other. But Turkish troops in Syria are, of course, fighting the Kurds that are fighting ISIS and the other jihadis and attempting to close the supply corridor from Turkey north of Aleppo, the Jarablus corridor, as it's called. On top of that, we have statements out of Turkey, out of the Turkish foreign minister, that it may be necessary for Turkey to put troops into Iraq to help take Mosul. And we've had similar sounding noises out of the U.S. Of course, Turkey has never given up its military bases that we've talked about in the last few weeks and the run-up to the holidays, that the government in Baghdad was screaming about. In fact, Turkey seems to have quietly settled in and you know, and solidified these bases basically on Iraqi held territory in the Iraqi Kurd, the Barzani homeland, Barzanistan, if you want to call it,
and Talibanistan.
Talibanistan. They have solidified their positions there, and obviously don't have any intentions to leave. And like I said, we've said discussed earlier, Turkey has long regarded Mosul, the whole area, as a piece of their territory that got away from it, and they have every right of extending their neo-Ottoman conquests into Iraqi as well as into northern Syria.
Hungary,
at
too,
the same
right?
time,
they reach to
the
Hungary
US,
too, don't they? They go all, Turkey goes all the way up to Hungary, doesn't it?
Yeah,
Hungary.
Yeah, of course.
Go ahead,
on top of this, the U.S. Defense Secretary Carter has announced that the fight against Daesh needs to be furthered, and it will require U.S. boots on the ground in Iraq and, wait for it, in Syria, right?
That's right.
Obama said 16 times there would be no boots on the ground in Iraq. He repeated the same thing in Syria.
Right.
And, of course, that's exactly where we are with just about the expected amount of time required for mission creep and for the country to forget the last time he denied this would happen.
Right.
The very quietly Al Jazeera reported during the week, and this has been backed up by Kurds on the ground, that the U.S. is building an air base in sovereign Syria,
right,
without the Syrian government's permission. The permission was neither asked nor given. And this is just another further erosion. So we've got the U.S. building an air base in northern Syria, ostensibly to fight ISIS, and also saying that they will need combat troops in Syria as well as Iraq. And we already know they've come out of the closet about the special forces they have running around there.
That's right.
Leading, exactly what forces, no one exactly is sure. We've got strong evidence that they're training Islamists to use tow weapons. We saw that in northern Latakia.
Right.
They're... And just as the end game comes in sight, and we start to see the damage that the Russian air game is really having on the logistics, the economy, the infrastructure, the morale of not only ISIS, who has had to cut their pay in half, by the way, they're paying their jihadists half what they used to now, but also on Ahrar al-Sham, the Islamic Front, Jaish al-Islam, Al-Qaeda and their allied FSA, the whole nine yards are wilting all over the country as the Syrian Arab Army is really starting to make territorial, not just strategic, but territorial advances. Now,
let me just bring something up here, and it's a question for you at the end of this, Eric. I have a client, an attorney, real estate attorney, who sent me a note last night. Her mother has a friend whose house has a neighbor who just built a wall that goes into his property. And so she wants to discuss with me the law of this encroachment, how to eject them from the property, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm working on this later today. How do you go from a legal system that deals with issues of property, jurisdiction, and such at a micro level to building a military base on someone else's territory without permission in direct violation of international law? And what's going to happen at the UN, do you think, over this?
Nothing.
Nothing is the short answer. Unfortunately, there is simply nothing that will happen at the international level. The United States will be able to do this. Quite frankly, this is the might makes right principle. The United States feels that they have every right to do this because in their twisted logic, the Assad government is illegitimate. It has lost its legitimacy. Therefore, that is all the pretext the United States needs. Right, exactly. That's all the pretext the U.S. needs to be able to do this. Now, I want to discuss something that is quite striking here from a strategic perspective, because all indications are that this information which has come out about the United States building this base, I mean, this is not
let's be clear. That is an invasion. It is an act of aggression against another state in violation of the UN Charter.
Invasion and occupation. It's an occupation of the land.
There is a resolution that requires, a UN Security Council resolution that requires all countries to make military efforts against the Islamic State. But it specifically says within the contours of existing international law, and that means you have to work with the Syrian government, whether you personally like them or not.
That's right.
No doubt about it. You know, it strikes me that, talking about whether or not there would be any consequences for the United States doing this, I mean, it strikes me as like, giving a jaywalking citation to someone after they robbed a bank.
Jafari's out of town now, isn't he? Isn't Jafari out of town right now? Isn't he the negotiator at for the Syrian peace talks? I think they pulled him out.
I missed the first part of what you said.
Jafari, the permanent representative to the UN from Syria.
Yes.
Isn't he out of town right now? So where he might have held a presser yesterday when this was announced, I'm wondering if it was sequenced that way, that as soon as he left town to go to negotiate, because he's their star.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, Dr. Jafari is I mean, he's great. I mean, he's great at what he does. So there's no doubt. Now, I want to look at a strategic question here because this is what really interests me. The information about the U.S. Building this base, this is not something that the media can chalk up to Russian propaganda or anything like that. This comes directly from Stratfor, which is, I mean, very much sort of the private wing of U.S. intelligence, as
it
were.
It's also and, Al Jazeera, which is the Qatari propaganda
channel. Right. So this is something that is really, I think, at this point beyond dispute. What is very interesting, though, is amid all of this talk of Turkey and the U.S. inside of Syria, we now have a report, interestingly buried in the headlines on a Friday afternoon with a snowstorm dominating the headlines in the United States, a story from Fox News carried on CNN and a bunch of other places that apparently they have intelligence that a small Russian contingent is looking at the city of Kamishli near the border between Syria and Turkey to possibly build a Russian airfield. Now, there's two ways to look at this. Number one, there's two ways to look at it. Number one, this is just pure propaganda saying, you see, this justifies what the U.S. is doing because that's what the Russians are doing. Secondarily,
they have the permission from the Syrian government, though.
Right. Well, let's not get bogged down in uncomfortable legality facts here for a second. The issue, though, is secondarily, if we're to assume that this is true, and I think it's possible, it's entirely possible, then we have to ask ourselves, is Russia now positioning itself not only to countermove what the U.S. and Turkey are doing inside of Syria, but now is Russia presenting itself as actually making tangible progress on the ground towards an alliance with the Kurds? Because if you look at the map, you look at where this is supposedly happening, this city near the Turkish border, this is a mixed city with a major Kurdish population in the northeast corridor of Turkey, of Syria, where you have this major Kurdish enclave. And the question now is, all of the inroads that Russia has made with the Kurds, is this now translating into on-the-ground changes that allow Russia to actually operate as more than just in alliance with the Syrian government, but actually now in alliance also with the Kurds? If you look at the map where this is supposedly taking place, we're talking not that far from Hasaka, from the capital of Hasaka governorate. This is a major northeastern province of Syria, absolutely critical to securing the entire Kurdish section of the country. Now, this is a very important, I think, watershed moment in this war. If the Kurds are now really and truly aligning themselves more with Russia than with the United States, then we know exactly what that means for the ultimate negotiation process, because that's really where this is going. That's what Russia has been pushing towards. Obviously, the United States wants to be able to manage and manipulate and control and dominate any negotiation process. They can't do that if the United States is really only speaking for the Sunnis and the various other foreign jihadis, because if the Kurds and the Assad government are more or less on the same page with Russia, that strengthens the Syrian government's bargaining position tremendously. This is absolutely critical. The second part of
Let me just do something with Turkey.
Is going to use air power inside of Syria, will Turkey really do that if they have to overfly a Russian base?
Yeah, those are we'll come back to local for a minute. Something interesting to do is pull out your map from Finland to Turkey and look at the positioning of a Russian air base in Syria there at that point as a counter move to the encircling of Russia that's been taking place.
Yeah, no, exactly. Now, there's one other point I want to make here. We have conflicting reports as to what exactly the purpose of this U.S. Military installation is. On the surface, the cover story, from my perspective, what they're saying is this is to set up the United States to be able to make real inroads as far as air power against the Islamic State in that part of Syria. However, if you actually look at what Stratfor wrote about this issue, they're saying the United States is building this base in order to reinvigorate its support for the rebels. Now, yeah. Those are not only diametrically opposed objectives, right. They are in many ways mutually exclusive, right. I think, in a sense.
One gives the lie to the other.
I'm sorry?
One gives the lie to the other.
Right, exactly. In other words, they're not doing both of those things from this small installation. It's one or the other, and I'm willing to bet you it's not to fight the Islamic State.
Mark, go ahead.
All right. Well, I mean, this was inevitable when Turkey shot down the Russian Su-24 over the Turkish-Syrian border. Mm-hmm. It was clear right away that part of Russia's response, other than the diplomatic and the sanctions, would be to support the Kurds, right? Turkey is upset about their Turkmen and jihadis being upset. They shot down the plane. Well, Russia says, all right, this is all too easy. You're already on the precipice of a civil war in your own country. Right. And we have a long history of working with the Kurds during the Cold War. Oh. So we've already seen Russia arming the Kurds and providing close air support for them in at least a few battles. And the fact that Russia will probably become the best guarantor of, at the very least, a substantial autonomy for the Kurds within the borders, the rejuvenated borders of Syria. And, you know, we can go from there into discussions about, you know, independence if we want. But no one can enforce that better, both militarily and politically, with the Syrian government than Russia. Right. And the Kurds in Syria and Turkey are starting to realize that.
And for what it matters, legally.
And you know what? You know what else is really important here? And I don't want to leave it out because I think it's really, you know, this is kind of at the foundation of everything I've been doing as far as the Syria issue going back to 2011, namely the legitimate and legal government of Syria, that is the government led by Bashar al-Assad. That government has a very important stake in this Kurdish question because the Kurds have been sort of tenuously at various times in an alliance de facto with the Assad government, sometimes fighting against them, wavering between the two sides. The
never
issue
directly engaging in conflict with the Syrian government.
Right, never. But not sometimes working at, let's call it, cross purposes if we want to be nice about it. But the issue, the reason I bring this up is because it is clear to me from a strategic perspective, Assad and the government in Damascus is perfectly happy with this arrangement because they want to see the Kurds act as a buffer between Syria and Turkey. They want that. They want exactly that scenario to play out. So for Russia to then inject themselves into this and really kind of make themselves into, as Mark, I think, correctly indicated, a guarantor for the Kurds, I think that serves the Syrian government's purposes perfectly. And now, obviously, there are people in Washington who are tremendously upset by such a development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've seen the peace talks, this Vienna 2, essentially collapse, right? Due one to the jihadists that Saudi has assembled in Riyadh, where already during the talks, one of the second major faction after ISIS,
Nusra.
No, not Nusra. Ahrar al-Sham walked out of the talks angrily, rejecting the words democracy, rejecting the words of any opposition that weren't Islamists or weren't actively engaged in, you know, trying to overthrow the Syrian government. That opposition wasn't allowed in the talks. You know, the legitimate political opposition that never picked up arms or was never backed by Saudi Arabia to overthrow the Syrian government. They refused to have those in the talks. And on the other hand, the Turks have steadfastly refused to accept the Kurds in the talks, which is just stupidity, of course, considering that they're U.S. as well as Russian allies in all of this. So the peace talks have already essentially collapsed. And as we talked previously, Russia knows this. They're going through the necessary diplomatic motions.
Everybody knows this. Let me say also, remember that Assad's government said that, I don't remember which spokesperson said it, but they said that they would go to listen but not negotiate. Now, that's an important indication of what they feel about the changes on the battlefield in the last couple of months, about how much stronger their position is today than it was even 3 months ago.
Washington knows this because the Washington Post had an article this
week
talking about how Russians support the airstrikes, air campaign, and all the other military support, you know, such as rebuilding the Syrian army through artillery combined arms operations, which aren't as addressed, you know, in the press, but that these have been too successful and that talks were in jeopardy because now the Syrian government was in a position of too much strength, you know, basically acknowledging that, you know, the West only viewed these talks as a way of forcing a capitulation and regime change. And now that that's no longer in the cards, you know, they're not even interested in the talks.
In other words, let me just restate that in clearer terms for our audience. That was clear enough, honestly, but just to make the point. Before, they were saying that Russia is in there to shore up Assad, and now they're saying Assad has been shored up.
Yes.
Well, we touched on this slight disagreement last week, and I'll just reiterate my point here. I think that the position of the Assad government and the Syrian Arab Army and all of their allies is that they want to defeat jihadis on the battlefield. I do believe there will be a political dialogue with certain actors that are going to be deemed at least to some degree acceptable by, if not Assad himself and the Assad government, certainly by Russia, who benefits tremendously from coming out of all of this as a peacemaker. If Russia looks like they have pushed a dialogue that is ultimately successful, then Russia scores a huge PR victory. And I think that ultimately that's precisely what they're aiming for. I don't think Russia's disingenuous at all. And I'm not suggesting that's what Mark's saying, but some people argue Russia's disingenuous in talking about negotiations. I don't buy that. I think Russia is very genuine about it. I think the issue is how to shape the situation on the battlefield such that the parties that will come to the table are not Saudi proxies and jihadis, but are, you know, the various traitors and various other degenerates that are proxies of the United States that are, you know, not jihadis. I think that is the real issue here, because if anybody believes, and this is just my personal take here, if anybody believes that the United States and its allies are just going to pack it all up and go home and take a loss with dignity or something like that, I don't see that in the cards. They're going to keep coming and coming and coming as much as they can until they're forced by a political solution to stop.
Look at Venezuela for that. I mean, you know, they lose every election there is, and they keep coming back.
Let's crunch
the economy. Yeah. Put the people in the street.
But a political solution, as you said, can only come after defeating the jihadists on the battlefield. Right. And that is, at the very least, 90%+ of the people who are fighting out there on the opposition side. At the end, some some of the Syrian National Coalition, whatever, sipping their coffee in Istanbul, will be trotted forward to sign a piece of paper and be given some small position in the future Syrian government, you know, in charge of trash removal in Aleppo or something like that.
But it won't just be them. I mean, that's true, of course. I agree with that. But it won't just be them. There will be some who picked up arms against the government who will be at that table, including the semi-mythical Free Syrian Army, including some other elements that have been on the battlefield. So I don't think that what we're, you know, we're talking just solely about people in suits. There will be people who fought in this war, but and Assad is going to come out with some kind of an amnesty for those people who participate in this dialogue. That process is going to happen no matter what anybody thinks about what's going to happen on the battlefield. The issue is that the war right now that the Syrian Arab Army and their allies are fighting is a war against the foreign proxy jihadists. Once they can break the backbone of that infrastructure, they're willing to go into the political process. And I think ultimately that's what's going to bring us a solution.
That's right.
Russia has outright said that Ahrar al-Sham is an offshoot of al-Qaeda. So neither Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahrar al-Sham will ever be considered by Russia or the Syrian government legitimate for transition. That's already the two largest quote-unquote anti-Assad rebel groups other than ISIS out there. Then they've also said the same about Jaish al-Islam, which is an operations room that includes many more brigades than this. So these are the forces that will not be part of any future Syrian government. These are the hardcore Saudi and Qatari proxies. What Russia is doing, Russia's been very quiet about this whole U.S. airbase, building of the U.S. airbase, and about Turkish incursions and into northern Syria now, and about the U.S. saying it will put boots on the ground in Syria. Russia has not gone out of their way to bring this to the Security Council or even in the Russian press. They've not made a lot of hay out of this yet. That's because Russia already has counters in place for this. They are continuing. This is already probably factored into their strategy. They think that they can deal with this, and they think that they need to at some point provide the U.S. an exit ramp to walk down. And maintaining the fiction that this is about just about some anti-ISIS fight, when we all know that the U.S. isn't concerned primarily with fighting ISIS. They are concerned with bringing down the Syrian government first and probably creating some type of post-Islamic State in the east of Syria and the west in Iraq. Russia has to provide some exit ramp for the U.S. to step down from this position. And by maintaining this fiction that it is a joint anti-ISIS fight, which the U.S. keeps trying to protest that they're really not in any kind of cooperation at all, very vocally. But Russia keeps, maintaining this, diplomatic fiction of being partners. And that is for this inevitable political transition that will only come not now with Vienna talks, but down the road through a much harder fought fight on the battleground.
Dimas Stora is going to be convening the meetings. And who is it in Jordan that's so preparing the list that Lavrov and Kerry and everybody are giving of this is a terrorist group?
Jordan has said that they will not release that group, that list, to the public.
Right. That's the foreign minister, Nasser Judeh.
Yeah. You don't have a right to know who is a terrorist in Syria and who's not.
Right. It's a secret list. Hey, maybe they can submit that in London to the Owen Commission.
Yeah, to some court. Yeah, so some kangaroo
Owen.
Court.
Yeah, Sir Owen. Go ahead, Eric. Go ahead.
Well, one thing that occurs to me about all of this, and it's kind of going back to my previous comment here, is that Russia is, I think, also preparing the groundwork for a political process that is going to allow them to achieve all of the objectives that they set out for themselves. Obviously, one of the objectives was destroying the terrorist infrastructure. They're obviously doing that, and that's not something that happens at a negotiating table. But just as we were mentioning earlier, when the U.S. builds, or takes control of a base and sets themselves up, and then we have a report that Russia is doing the same thing, not that far away, doesn't that smell to you like preparing the ground for the concessions that they're all expecting to demand of each other? Yeah. That the Russians will say, sure, we'll dismantle our base as soon as the U.S. dismantles theirs, and you know, we'll pull back, the U.S. will pull back, and we'll let the Syrians decide. I see this political process that the U.S. and Russia are really the central players in, I think, evolving in that way, concession for concession, slowly but surely the mutual distrust translates into a mutually agreed upon de-escalation.
That's the big problem I have with that is, does anyone believe that the U.S. can seriously bring their rabid dogs, Turkey, Saudi, and Qatar, into line with all of that? Because
no,
I think that Russia
believes they don't need to convince Turkey and Qatar and the rest of them. All they need to convince is some of the realists in Washington to do it. Without Washington directly backing them, I think Russia believes, and I think they're correct to believe it, that Turkey and Saudi Arabia are paper tigers.
What realists in Washington?
There are no
realists in Washington.
Well,
the only realists in the U.S. are people like Stephen Walt, who are sitting in academia because they aren't represented any of the foreign policy elite or circles of the United States.
Or
there are
Cohen.
No realists.
Now, I will say, well,
even
okay.
Cohen
now here's
too,
what I will say about that, though. I agree with you. That's my inclination. I don't know whether or not everybody believes that. You know, if you read Joshua Landis's piece in Foreign Affairs,
who is also in academia.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, all right.
Of course. But it should be noted, I mean, Landis in many ways is a de facto spokesperson for an entire segment of the State Department and the sort of intelligence establishment. I mean, Landis is certainly, let's say, if not directly speaking for a part of the establishment, he certainly represents a certain viewpoint, a realistic viewpoint, I think, that is increasingly gained traction within certain elements of the Obama administration, I believe. Now, whether or not that is a consensus view, I don't think anybody would believe that. But look, these things are fluid, and what Landis was writing, and I think it's an interesting point, is that Obama, just as Mark was saying earlier, Obama basically will also want an exit strategy. And just as Mark was saying, Russia's providing for them, I think that Obama might be looking for one.
Now, whether or not
that is actually going to come about, and whether or not Obama himself has any say in that, I don't really believe that. I don't think Obama controls U.S. foreign policy or what the U.S. is really doing on the ground in Syria entirely. That's the complicated element of what's happening in Washington. It's not a monolith.
That's right. Listen, let me just read the very first paragraph of Landis's piece. I assume this is the one you're talking about. Assad has it his way, the peace talks and after.
Yes.
President Bashar al-Assad is winning in Syria. That's the first sentence. Russia has shifted the balance of power there dramatically. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the U.N. might insist that Assad negotiate with his opponents and ultimately cede power to them, but the Syrian president has no intention of accepting such demands. His advisors state he will go to talks in Geneva this month, quote, to listen but not to negotiate, close quote, as you guys said. In other words, he's still out for victory on the battlefield. As the United States enters the now-delayed UN negotiating process, it will have to stay flexible in its expectations and objectives in light of the shifting military balance on the ground.
Exactly. I agree with that.
Okay, well, the assertion that Joshua Landis in any way represents any faction of the State Department, parentheses, Mark Sloboda raises his eyebrows and rolls his eyes histrionically, end parenthesis.
And Stephen Simon. Stephen Simon co-wrote it.
Yeah. But look, we talked earlier about how the U.S. can flagrantly violate international law vice, you know, its pursuit of property in micro law. This is not only an issue of power, but it is a basic premise of realist international relations theory, the fact that because there is no overriding world government, thank God, that the states exist and interact each other within a state of relative anarchy.
Yep, that's true.
This is where the U.S. And the other five powers sitting on the Security Council have a great deal of impunity, and there they do use force, military, economic, diplomatic, to have their way, and they do sit largely above the other countries. Let's not maintain any type of utopian fiction where we pretend all states are equal. China is not equal to the government of Palau. Let's just be honest about that. That is a legal fiction as much
Palau is a staunch U.S. ally and votes with the U.S. at the U.N.
Yep. Not always. They've actually gone out a few times, but in recent days. But let's talk about what type of consequences 10, 20 years down the road could befall the U.S. leaders that we're looking at today. It won't be an international criminal court. We will never see Bush or Obama or Clinton, sitting in The Hague, any more than we will Tony Blair. But eventually there will be a reassessment in the U.S., and it is very possible that someday we may see Obama and Hillary Clinton and Ashton Carter, Brennan and others, we may see them sitting before a U.S. court being charged under U.S. domestic law, anti-terrorist law, with knowingly providing material support for terrorists in Syria. That is something that the American people can really move towards. And I think eventually we will see that type of reassessment. But it won't be Obama anymore. It will happen in the near future any more than it will be that Obama will end the Syrian conflict. This is, of course, going to be passed on, right? Obama has created this situation where he is not in control of the Pentagon. He's not in control of the intelligence department. There is no overarching strategy, and the U.S. is in a real strategic mess. Their division and Obama's inability to take control of the institutions of government or effectively make up his mind in one way or the other about what he's doing have led to paralysis of the U.S. government. And the moment for a possible de-escalation in Syria and the U.S. taking some type of exit ramp and real peace negotiations taking place will be when the next president takes office.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, as you said, by the way, the administration itself is so conflicted, let alone the government, Congress and all the institutional people. It's worth mentioning, by the way, with respect to that Landis piece, that Simon spent 5 years, as a White House aide, including two as running security policy in the Near East.
Yeah, this is I'll respectfully disagree with Mark on this point that I do think that Landis, when he speaks, does speak for a segment of the U.S. policy establishment. I think that these people are increasingly marginalized, perhaps. But I do think that he does. And I think that that paragraph that Don read, I think, is quite telling. That is not how Landis was speaking 2 years ago. I've been reading Syria
right.
Comment. Landis's blog
yes,
for a yes, long time. He was
he's
never
speaking a long way.
He's come a long way. He was never speaking that way before. And And I think that that illustrates a recognition on the part not only of Landis and Simon, but on the part of people like them who have knowledge of the region, to on whom many people in Washington lean for advice, whether they'll admit to it or not. So I'll disagree with Mark. I think Landis does speak for the State Department, not the State Department itself, but an element within it
that isn't allowed to voice itself.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. It's voicing itself in the preeminent publication of the Council on Foreign Relations,
but not officially.
Probably the most highly regarded publication on foreign affairs in the world.
But not officially. They're saying it as an academic and as a former State Department careerist.
Yeah, but these guys always, I mean, that when they speak as an academic, but they're also speaking, they're wearing multiple hats at the same time.
I think we're talking semantics on the term official.
Minority that thinks that, Eric. I certainly hope that that is true. And towards how far Landis has come in this conflict, in the last year, he was on crosstalk with me. We found
me
a lot of common ground laughing at the neocons, and we've become friends online since then, following each other on social media. So I think Landis is cut. You're right. You know, I've been following Syria comment just like you from the beginning of this. You know, kudos to Landis, you know, who has a Syrian wife, actually.
And let's not forget Landis, who supported, you know, what I would consider the wrong side in this war for a long time. Landis is on record exposing, actually quite early on, by comparison to some other people, exposing the jihadi nature of a lot of those groups, including Jaish al-Islam, Zahran Alush, the Alush Brigade, that whole faction. I mean, he wrote it up in 2013. I quoted him in my article extensively. Yep. He said exactly who these people were. He was never under any delusions about that. Now, I think that his anti-government position has been a bit, let's call it, biased from the beginning. But that's his bias. That's his perspective. And I think that it's certainly worth reading, and it's certainly worth considering. And I think that increasingly over the course of this conflict, more and more people have looked at him and said, you know what? I think this guy knows what he's talking about, including people in the U.S. government.
Yeah, he came down. He finally was forced to admit the reality of who the quote anti-Assad rebels, at least the vast majority of them, were, rather than what he and many people, liberals in American foreign policy circles, wish they were, right. Which is an important distinction. We saw that in Libya and Egypt.
He's speaking with an element of realism. That's why he's realism, worth reading.
Yes, yes. And while we're giving a shout out to Landis and Stephen Walt at Harvard and foreign policy, let me just give a quick shout out. If you're not following Land Destroyer, Moon of Alabama, and Al Masdar News under the Twitter handle at the Arab Source, you should be, because those are the sources in English that I'm reading, and I know I'm pretty sure that Eric and Don DeBar is reading as well. These are some bloggers and some local news in Syria that you really should be reading.
I was sort of co-editing Land Destroyer, so I'll take it.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. Let me just give a little amplification. Amplification to the point you were making about Landis before. Not to make this the Joshua Landis show, but June of 2012, okay, in Foreign Policy, this is his article, and he wrote it alone. Stay out of Syria, or in any event, it's his byline alone. Stay out of Syria. Foreign intervention to topple Bashar al-Assad's bloody regime risks a fiasco on par with Iraq and Afghanistan. And he begins that article saying, let's be clear, Washington is pursuing regime change by civil war in Syria. That says, basically, he says that the U.S. Is shoveling resources to the rebels and that they should do that, and it's the most they should do. He predicted it would change the balance of power in favor of what he called the revolution.
Yeah.
Right. So again, I mean, a lot of truth wrapped up in some, you know, not so great ideological positions. But again, I mean, if you read his stuff regularly, you find an incredible amount of not only movement in terms of his own position, but an incredibly good amount of accurate information going back a long way. So yeah. I take what Landis says very seriously, and the fact that it's in Foreign Affairs, the publication of the Council on Foreign Relations, which is so intimately connected to the political establishment, I think that is telling, and I don't think that we should underestimate that.
Washington watching.
Yep.
All right. This is an excellent point, of course, to segue into at least a short discussion of the American elections that are taking place. And I'll just go out there and drop a bomb that I know Eric and I were discussing after the show last week. I think that the world, that real leftists in the United States and the world in general, should hope for something that's not going to happen, not going to be allowed to happen, of course, because I don't think he's a real candidate. But we should all wish that Donald Trump was elected president of the United States. Yes, I'm gonna go out and say it.
And I will be on the record and say that I told Mark once before, I'll say again, much easier to say that when you don't live here.
I don't live there. And I represent the rest of the world or the Americans who have escaped outside of the United States.
Right, that's right.
I will admit an extra percentage, 2 points to this domestic program or a knot that happens when Republicans and Democrats change chairs. Right. It doesn't matter.
I agree with that.
Europe, disgusted with a U.S. Trump presidency that they doubled down on the Bush years and really broke relations with the United States would mean so much geopolitically for the world it would be worth it.
Regardless,
rejuvenate the anti-war movement that has just forgotten their reason since a Democrat got elected to office.
this is like debating, what would be the implications if I won the New York Marathon this year? This is simply never going to happen. Not only is it not going to happen, I can say that just on a logic level, even the numbers indicate that. The numbers indicate, and this came out recently from multiple sources, including very highly respected polling sources and studies. I believe Bernie Sanders...
The Democratic Party, so it doesn't matter. I agree.
But I believe Bernie Sanders beats Trump in a general election something like 480 to like 110 or whatever it is in the electoral college. Hillary Clinton trounces Trump in a general election, and it's a landslide.
Ten points right now.
10 points is nothing. That has nothing to do with the Electoral College and the way that these elections actually go. It's a matter of getting those electors. Hillary Clinton will defeat Bernie Sanders. There's no doubt in my mind. And she has the superdelegates. Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. In a general election, Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton versus Ted Cruz trounces both of them by all studies and all measures, and it's not even close.
Let me just say this.
We've seen one or two polls that give a 10-point lead to Clinton at this theoretically.
We've also seen
polls from The Hill, right? One of the most respected congressional sources out there, showing that 20% of Democrats would be willing to defect to vote for Trump over Clinton.
I'm not talking about percentages. I'm talking about projected electoral score.
Yeah, projections in January. January projections, though, at that. But look, regardless, we're going to find this question will be settled in the primaries, of course, and on Election Day, or in the Supreme Court later. Who knows?
Hillary could lose to Bernie in Iowa and in New Hampshire, and she'll still trounce him. and get the nomination because of how ridiculous the U.S. electoral system is and because of the fact that Wall Street is backing her. Until we see a shift in Wall Street from Hillary to Bernie, I'm not buying Bernie for a second. Right. It's just like 2000.
Okay, let me seg out of this for a minute. Let's go to this the larger question here that Mark raised. Because I'd like to go there. I mean, the argument that Mark is making essentially is that Trump would be such a lousy president that he would alienate so many American allies that it would reconfigure the global geopolitical scene.
Yeah, from the position that we could never elect a real leftist, much less Bernie Sanders, to the United States. And after Obama, real leftists should learn the lesson that political change in the United States will never – good political change will never come via – the ballot box. Right. So the best thing we could do is actually elect the worst.
Right. I understand the logic. You know, you do know that was the logic of part of the left and of the bourgeoisie in Germany.
In 1930s. Yeah, exactly.
That's how Hitler came to power.
I'd like to go on the record, though, that I actually agree with Jeb Bush on something. I've been saying it for a long time. I do not believe that Donald Trump is a real candidate. I do not believe he's as stupid as the positions he's putting forward. I think he's a poison pill, a character for the Clintons to destroy the Republican Party making this appeal to the Fox News base against the Republican Party elite and mandarins.
That's been his profession.
To continue the Clinton dynasty.
That's been his profession. He was a play pretend business executive on television firing people for a very long time. He is the face of corporations, including mafia, that build casinos and apartment buildings and all of that. He sells his name to them. He did it right here in White Plains. He sold it to Capelli, who was actually the developer that became Trump Towers in White Plains. They wrote him a check and they stuck Trump on the side of the building, and now it's Trump. And people have an image of him
I agree with Mark again, as I most of the time do. I think that Trump is a fake. I think U.S. elections in general are nothing but theater. I have a piece coming out in the next few days to that effect. Exactly. Right. I believe the title of my upcoming article is "Dear America, Your Elections Are Political Theater, Nothing More." Yep. And that is what this is. Eric. I would argue, I would even go one step further, that that's the same thing Bernie Sanders has been doing, upholding Hillary Clinton's left flank. I think that Bernie Sanders from the beginning thought that and has begun to buy in to his own momentum, and he's running a real campaign now, which is not what he was doing originally. However, all of that being said, I am not buying Bernie. I'm not buying Trump. This is Hillary all the way into the White House.
I agree. But you should buy one of those two.
Right. All right. Well, let's segue out of here. We have 5 minutes left. Let's segue. Okay. Let's segue into Venezuela.
Very quickly. I just wanted to talk a little bit about Venezuela because of the major developments there. Just the other day, we had yet another high-profile assassination. This is on the heels of the really devastating assassination in late 2014 of Robert Serra, who was a young, up-and-coming leader within the Socialist Party. He was seen as the next Chavez. He was brutally assassinated by contract killers connected directly to the former president of Colombia. Right. This is another example of how the Colombian paramilitaries and the Colombian professional killers infiltrate into Venezuela to do the dirty work of the right wing. Right. Now, that was in 2014. Just the other day, we had another sad example of an assassination. This is Ricardo Duran, who is a well-known journalist and a spokesperson for the Socialist Party, murdered outside of his home, one single shot to the head, assassination style, execution style, I should say, clearly a professional job. Now, the reason we have to bring this up is because the political conflict that is ongoing in Venezuela between the right wing, which now controls the National Assembly, and the Bolivarian Revolution, the Chavistas, who control the executive branch and the army and the judiciary to a large extent as well. So this ongoing conflict is now also this low-intensity war, which we've seen going on for a long time with these targeted assassinations. Now, there is a major movement of people inside of Venezuela who are really up in arms about this latest killing. This is on the heels of Maduro really pushing to undermine the right wing in the National Assembly by moving the executive branch closer to the grassroots movement. That's the community councils, the commune movements, the local organizations, the agricultural organizations. All of these different grassroots elements are now in the so-called communal parliament, which is now directly in contact with the executive branch of the government. This is an outgrowth of the tremendous defeat the socialists had in the elections in December. This is how they're trying to reconnect back to the grassroots. One of the principal ways that the right wing is trying to undermine the government is by going not only on this killing spree, of course, but by trying to reinvigorate the media, the right wing media, pushing it heavily against the government and trying to force a conflict. My fear, and I know we're almost out of time here, my fear, and this is why I follow it closely, why everybody should be paying attention, is that the right wing, and when I say right wing, I'm not getting into a right left issue. When right wing is a synonym in Latin America, is a synonym for proxies of the US. Right. The right wing in all of these countries are proxies of the United States.
Right.
So what they are looking to do potentially is to bring this conflict to a head. And when they can bring violence into the streets and from their perspective, force a crackdown by the government, then turn around and say that the government is killing its own people, et cetera, et cetera. They're looking for an excuse for intervention.
And they'll be,
this is going.
And asked by the National Assembly, asking.
Remember, Obama himself, the great hope and change Obama, the great emancipator for Cuba, Obama has called Venezuela a threat to U.S. national security. Now, that's not just a phrase, you know, for headlines. Yes. That indication, that designation allows the United States to do certain things in relation to Venezuela that I think border on intervention, and it will provide the pretext that the U.S. needs for a potential intervention. Now, what a U.S. intervention in Venezuela would look like, it would not look like Libya, but it would be done through the conduit of Colombia, which is one of the major recipients of U.S. aid through the Plan Colombia project. Billions upon billions of U.S. dollars flood into Colombia. Colombia is the principal antagonist in a conflict with Venezuela. They are a U.S. proxy. Yep. That is where this is headed.
Okay.
Exactly. Go ahead, Eric. Exactly right. Eric, this is just U.S. imperialism and its proxies and Contras, this assassination. And Eric, if you will remember, before you even left on your trip to Venezuela for the elections, I asked you then if this would end in civil war. And I'm still saying it. This is going to end in civil war. Oh, civil war, of course, extending into a larger intervention by Colombia and the United States.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. So thank you very much, guys. A pleasure as always. And I look forward to doing this again next week.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Mark. Always a pleasure.
Guys, always fun.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.